Okay, what's on your mind today?
Oh, a whole bunch, I guess.
Really?
Yeah, a whole bunch.
Good.
But I think I told you last time we talked, I've got this giant list of, things to talk with Paul about.
Oh boy.
And I always do. But I think the one thing that we could talk about, that I don't think I've heard many people talk to you about, at least. Well, a lot of people approach this subject. I want to talk about what really grabbed me in with the whole Jordan Peterson phenomenon and why I latched onto him initially. And
Okay.
it's something that I don't hear a lot of people talk about. So I guess when Peterson first kind of made his splash, my life was already pretty much in order in a lot of ways. I was 25. I was married with a kid and a good job and a house.
Wow.
Things were going pretty well just
You're
because
ahead of the curve.
I was on the path. Yeah. So it's that kind of classic thing where I came to Peterson stuff for the controversy and then stayed for the content, So it was like all the political stuff and the ramifications of all that, it was refreshing and nice to hear. And I liked him for all of those reasons. But I think what really stuck with me originally was, so I'm a visual thinker, and when I'm learning something or when I'm thinking about something, I'm kind of building like models of things in my mind. It's just kind of how I see things, and it's how I think and how I learn. And that's what Peterson did right off the bat. He started revealing in my mind this model of reality in a way. And I've now come to realize that it's the reality that you would call the forum for action. So it started on the very first podcast I heard him talk. I think it was with Joe Rogan is where he first talked about it. But he told the St. George story, but he told it from the point of his order chaos paradigm, I guess. So it's like George is in order in the castle. He goes out to face the dragon, and then he returns and he restores order. And that I just remember that shook me, just that little thing and the way that he a story. Just it stuck with me, and I even talked to my wife about it that night. I was just like, I can't believe like the effect that this had on me, just hearing that story. And then the more I would listen to his content, everything mapped onto that diagram where there's this center point that's order, and then there's periphery surrounding it. So it's George goes out to the dragon, or Harry Potter goes to face that, or Bilbo goes to Mordor, or the mother and the child in the playground, and she's the center point, and the child goes out to the periphery, faces chaos just till he's uncomfortable and returns to the restored order. The rats that are dropped in a new environment, they establish that tiny little center point of order, and then they slowly work their way out. So it paints this picture of this forum for action where it's like experienced reality. And the experiencer of that reality is always weaving between order, the known, and the chaos, the unknown, and kind of using the periphery to build the center, the order. And it just, I don't know, that mental diagram is what has kept me going and going and going into Peterson stuff. And then the more you get into it and into his material, you see that center point actually has a vertical axis, and it's an axis of value. So often the hero from the center point, he goes down to the periphery and then returns upward. So that diagram in my head starts to look like a cone in a way. You know what I mean? It's got the periphery, and the center axis goes up. And so then he talks about, Horus being at the top of the hierarchy, but also above the hierarchy. And he talks about Christ in the same way as well. He did that a lot in that transliminal interview, the one from 2015. And I think that it's when Jonathan Pageau came onto the scene is where I see, he's what really convinced me that this is more than just some really interesting way to look at reality. He kind of says, yeah, you think this is interesting and you see all these, what's the word? What's that Jungian word for things lining up? Synchronicities?
Synchronicity.
Yeah, he's a, you see all these, you see the way that this matches reality so frequently, and that's because this is reality. And Pajot's ideas, I always pronounce his name weird, Pajot.
That's the way to pronounce it, isn't it?
Yeah, Pajot? I guess I put the emphasis on the wrong syllable, as they say.
Oh, Pajot?
Yeah, Pajot.
Pajot.
Where was I going with that? I guess Jonathan, his big point that he made, especially just early on, was that this is the way reality is, and that Christianity itself describes this system very well. Mm-hmm. And when you, as I started to kind of make the transfer from understanding the system through Peterson's material to understanding it through Pajot's material, it kind of matches, but some of the labels on the diagram have to change in a way where order and chaos still work, technically speaking. Like at the center is the known, the order, and the periphery is the chaos, and the unknown and the potential. But when you have it as a cone, it's probably more accurate to describe it with unity at the top and multiplicity at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan goes into that a lot. But that gets in, I guess. Am I rambling? Is there anything?
No, keep going. You're doing good.
Okay.
I'm tracking.
Okay. Well, so with the unity and the multiplicity, that gets into the idea of logos. And Peterson and Pajot's ideas of logos are slightly off as well. And I remember when I first heard Jonathan say, you know, Jordan's close on logos, but it's a little bit off. It's not quite there. At first I was like, I didn't understand what he meant. But the more I listen to Jonathan's stuff, I've come to understand that. So Jordan talks about the logos as the capacity of consciousness through truthful speech to generate order from chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So that the experiencer faces chaos, regenerates order into him, and does it truthfully. And that's logos.
Mm-hmm.
But Jonathan's idea, it's not his idea, but what he says logos is the ability to create a unity from multiplicity. So it's kind of the same idea, but almost zoomed out a little bit more. It's the ability, he uses a pen. So he says a pen, there's infinite multiplicity in this pen. There's a spring, there's a little ball, there's a lid, there's these things. But we take all of that multiplicity and we make it one thing and we say pen. And that is logos, the ability to take those multiple things and make one thing, make a category or a concept of something.
Then, you know, from there you can kind of see Verveke's gestalt or the bird, formal cause from Aristotle.
I remember that when Verveke talked about the bird, the gestalt of the bird. I remember that.
And Peterson's part of what continues to there's a wall that Jordan keeps bumping up into, which he did on yesterday's Q&A, where when he has to talk about metaphysical ontology, mm-hmm. and that's the limit of his Darwinian epistemology, in that he can't get beyond that which promotes survival in the physical dimension. And so that's part of the reason why the way Peterson lays out logos, just as you described it, it's very determinative of consciousness, but the consciousness problem then continues to plague him, which obviously isn't as much of a problem if you're in fact a theist, because consciousness is a gift and it doesn't have to be accounted for via science, which of course Peterson and many others, and it's called the hard problem. They can't get there. So if you're a theist, consciousness isn't the hard problem. Consciousness is simply a given.
It's a given. That's funny. It's in the language too. It's a given. Given by what? It's a given.
It's a given. It's given because in a theistic framework, consciousness is foundational, and then the formal cause and the thing in the world is derivative of the consciousness. And that's why the big dividing line, the big fight of Darwin always winds up being, is there a designer? Is there a conscious cause to the shape of the world? And that's then the divide, that no, there is none. It's random, which is not really a response, because all random really means is too complicated for us to see. So random is, in a sense, a mystery that we say is godless, and the other is a mystery that we say is God.
But the
mystery on this side, they don't fess up to.
Yeah.
The mystery on this side, theists say, yeah, this is the part we can't explain. It's like the old joke, you know, that a Darwinian, an atheist would say, give me one miracle and I'll explain the rest. It's like,
yeah, you're always relying on something you don't understand.
You start somewhere. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to remember where I wanted to go with this thing. It's just this model of reality is what is so interesting to me. And an interesting thing that I've heard Jonathan talk about with that, the concept of unity and multiplicity, is that is also love.
Yes.
Love is the ability for unity and multiplicity to exist together, basically. Like myself and my wife are multiple, but we create a union, a unity. Yeah. And then there's the phrase that God is love. So God is that thing, the all things in one. But then I don't want to go into saying that this diagram I'm building in my head is actually God.
Right.
But I do want to say that whole thing is a picture of him in who we live and breathe and have our being. It is the reality that we consciously exist in. And to me, that is God one, if I can use your term. And maybe I'm using it wrong. But
no,
I think
that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Okay. I think so. And then, so I've heard you talk recently about, you know, people having problems either finding God one, believing in God one versus God two, and you kind of need God one to connect with God two. I am fully on board with God one because I can see how everything fits into that, this kind of reality that's being painted for me to see. God two is hard for me, and I'm trying really hard. Christ, a personal relationship with whatever it is that God is, in whatever way he could be personal.
If you have God two without God one, you have, let's say, maybe a Greek God. You have something, you have Zeus that can swoop in and, you know, impregnate a maiden. You do have relationality in the Greek gods, but you don't have God one in the Greek gods.
You're right.
Ironically, until, let's say, you get to Plato, and then almost all you have is God one in Plato.
Right.
There's no God two in Plato. So if you have Zeus and Plato, you've got a God one and a God two, but they can't come together.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, here's the thing. So then many people will say, okay, I'm there on God one, but God two. Well, here's the thing. You're not in charge. And that is really hard culturally for us to stomach. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, and this is sort of where the church comes in, because the church is where, in Christianity, the church is where God too lives.
Yeah,
it right. is the body of Christ.
Yeah, okay.
And then you've got the God one, God two dynamic a little bit wonky, because in some ways God one is sort of institutional and God two is sort of relational. And we can understand how institutions are relational and how we personify institutions. The American government is Uncle Sam. You know, so it's interesting how countries embody themselves in these, in a sense, if we lived 2,000 years ago, there'd be a statue of Uncle Sam that we would go to Washington, D.C. And so and that's why people go say, God one, okay, kind of get God one. And Peterson lays that out. But what about God two? And it's like, well, you kind of have to go to church to find God too, because that's where he lives. And also in another sense, I was just preaching on Sunday in Luke, revving up to the lectionary text. And again, Jesus, when he talks about perdition, says, go away from me, I never knew you. And people say, well, what do you, like, I thought God was omniscient. I thought God knows everything. Obviously, never knew you is a relational. It's not that I never knew of you. It's not that I can't see that you're a thing in the world. Mm-hmm. It's a relational thing. And when you read the Gospel of John, again and again, Jesus talks about God, you know, drawing those to Jesus that he wants. And this is where you set up some of the Calvinist dynamic. And Calvinism actually gets its election from the Western tradition, because it's there in Augustine. So that's why I say to people, well, God will come looking for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, also within the tradition, it's seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open. So you can go seek him. And in fact, you should go seek him. But just like in, let's say, a marriage relationship, one of the most frustrating things that people will bump into in terms of a marriage relationship is you are not in control. There's two people here.
Yeah.
And that's where you get into Peugeot's love observation, which is just brilliant. I was listening to his March question and answer, and I think Jonathan is just brilliant. I listened to him, but he's not always terribly accessible for a lot of people. You start listening to him and it's just like, what is he talking about?
Yeah, it
and
takes that, time. It
takes time to kind of, oh, okay, now it's coming together.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that helps at all.
No, it does. So I'm a visual thinker who thinks in these like images like this, but I also tend to get kind of analysis paralysis, you know, rather than I have, what was that? Node in the Network was putting out some videos recently called Abstracted to Death. And I do that with everything. I abstract and analyze things like this to where I've removed the personal aspect from it in a lot of ways. So it's hard, but then I find, I've got ideas going off, but so I can see Christ in that same model, that same kind of hierarchy model, because if he is the Logos, he is that which is unity and multiplicity. And there are things that match on to this kind of the shape that I'm keep talking about, where Christ says straight is the gate and narrow is the way. Yes. And like, you know, if this is reality, this cone thing we're talking about, and it's the central axis is based on value, then the ultimate highest value is at the top. And if that's heaven or God or ultimate goodness, we're supposed to aim there. And if Christ is up at the top at the point and he's saying, this is the narrow little gateway that you've got to get through, and you have to aim here with your behavior and your action has to aim here. So when you talk about being truthful, it's not so much about speaking the truth, but it could be about that, but true action as in properly aimed at the right target, which is that narrow gate. And to sin is to deviate, is to not be pointing where you need to be pointing. So you could sin or you could be true. You
right.
could aim true.
Right.
And I think of the word faith as well in the similar context, not so much as faith as in trusting or believing, but faith as in following. Faith as in
faith
like
as
being
in faithful.
Faithful, yes. Yeah, being faithful to Christ.
Sam is faithful to Frodo, and
yes.
that's his. I mean, that's the virtue he embodies in the story. Mm-hmm. Sam is the ultimate faithful servant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting in Lord of the Rings because every character, by embodying that which is there, so Sam is the ultimate faithful servant. Frodo is sort of a sacrificial lamb. You know, and Aragorn is the king, and you know, Tolkien gets to kind of map out these, and they each play their own role in the, you know, and Gandalf has a sacrificial element to him in his death and rebirth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. So yeah, so again, I can see Jesus in those roles. It's like he is the perfect example of the behavior that we should fulfill. Our behavior should aim for his behavior in a way, to follow that and be truthful to that. And again, I think I see all those things, but I'm personally removed.
Well, it's always important to remember that Jesus is one member of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is the icon of the invisible God. And mm-hmm. so Jesus manifests in our flesh the, you know, God with us. And so it's helpful to not see, in a sense, part of where all of our church traditions tend to, we're embodying some things and we're failing to embody other aspects. We can't embody the whole thing because we're human, but that's what we're pointing. You're exactly right. And so there's Jesus, but Jesus also, remember, the relationship between Jesus and the Father, which is very clear in the Gospel of John. And then Jesus ascends to the right hand of God, and the Spirit comes, and then the Spirit guides, and that is the Spirit of God, and it is also the Spirit of Christ. And then you have to think, I just did a whole bunch of things in my Sunday school class about this, then what do we mean by Spirit? And it's that, you know, the Spirit is like the wind. It's the animating element that, then that way it's sort of like Aristotle's formal cause. And then the Spirit shapes us and causes us to be in a particular shape that looks like Jesus, but the God of creation and the God of redemption are the same God. And so God doesn't just blow with wind. God moves through history and creation, and it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardest thing in our culture, I don't think our culture is unique in this, but it's particularly hard for our culture, is the idea that you are not in control of your own salvation. And that is, when you look at all the Peterson stuff, that's the point that Jordan Peterson and I stop. That because for Jordan Peterson's schema, carrying that cross up the hill is your salvation. And take up your cross and follow me. Yes, absolutely. Carry that cross up the hill. But we did not make the hill. I mean, there's finally, from the book of Jonah, salvation is of the Lord. And so I think about John Calvin's commentary with Jacob fighting with the angel of the Lord. And John Calvin says, on one hand, he opposes us. With the other hand, he fights for us. And so you have this sense of, okay. So then a lot of people are talking to me and they're like, oh, you know, I intellectually kind of see it, but I don't feel it. And so part of me says, okay, but remember, again, this is all God's work. And I always use the illustration of the Apostle Paul.
the Apostle Paul stands, if you read the book, if you read the book of Acts, Stephen is the most Christ-like figure in the book of Acts. Luke quite intentionally describes Stephen in similar terms that he described Jesus. And so there's set scenes that parallel. And so Luke is saying, Stephen is just like Jesus. And there's Paul, Saul, holding the coats of those who kill Stephen. And you might say, well, why does Jesus not appear to Saul before the stoning of Stephen? And I think it's significant that Paul has to see himself with blood on his hands. And that's part of the narrative he must play. So then God comes in at Damascus and calls him, and Ananias is unsure about going to him. But this whole thing is God's story, and he is calling the shots. And so, and you cannot understand the Christian life if you don't understand that God is finally in control. Because otherwise, what we wind up doing is just like we do with our American self-salvationism. Okay, I'm going to get the right education. I'm going to eat the right things. I'm going to exercise properly. I'm going to get the right job. I'm going to marry the right person. I'm going to tell the truth, or at least don't lie. I'm going to do all the correct things, and then I inherit the kingdom. No. The kingdom is a gift. We're saved by grace through faith. And so faith is this trust in the midst of, now you're young and your kids are young and you haven't had enough time for your life to fall apart significantly in some
That's
ways.
That's true. I'm waiting. It'll come.
And it will come. But see, that suddenly then, that's why in a sense, you don't have to go looking for your cross. Oh, your crosses will find you. Mm-hmm. And some of those, there'll be blood on your hands, because it's amazing that you have Peter and Judas. Mm-hmm. They both betray Jesus. Peter is restored, mm-hmm. and Judas falls away. And we say, why? Why? Can't answer those questions.
Wow. Jeez. I'm kind of speechless after that one.
But Americans hate this, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Because we want to be in control. And who I finally trust more than anyone else is me. Mm-hmm. What an idiot I am. I have abundant reasons that I can name that I will not hear to say why I am not trustworthy.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel the same way. I've noticed so last time we talked, we spoke about kind of my struggles in finding a church and finding the right match for one that fits me, fits my wife, and then where the heck do kids fit into any of that? I'm going a few different directions, but on that note of just kind of like our American ideas of individualism versus the church as a community and the body of Christ kind of thing. When I'm in a church, my instinct, especially if I attend like a Catholic practice, which I have a strong leaning towards Catholicism, but every time I go, my American individualism turns into a porcupine. You know, it's like, don't put me into your group. I'm not in your group. You know, I'm me. And then that voice in my head says, yeah, you're not going to get anywhere that way, you know? So I know that, and I'm starting to realize that maybe this individualism it's been a strength in a lot of ways for our country, especially, but where are we now? We're lonely, and we're just a lonely culture. Everyone's in solitude. You don't know your neighbors, and it's because you're just all individuals.
You have no tribe.
Yeah.
You're not part of one of the topics at one of our last meetups was ethno-nationalism or constitutional nationalism. Does the nation, America, is it constitutional? You know, we organize around the Constitution. The countries of Europe, they're ethnic groups, or, you know, the fragmentation, the balkanization. Here's our little ethnic tribe. Well, it's really handy to make that your group. But then the problem that you have is the problem of empire, which actually, if you read the Bible, it's a wrangling with empire. And finally, the answer in the Bible is, well, the final state of the world is empire, and the emperor is Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's Book of Daniel, Book of Revelation. Yeah, yeah. And but then there's a competing empire, and that's Babylon, Egypt, Rome, Satan.
Yeah. And so that kind of maps on to a while ago, you've heard Jonathan talk about hierarchies of consciousness and then kind of principles and principalities, and how this realm of consciousness also organizes itself in that cone hierarchical shape, where there's an individual, and at the top is his conscious guidance, and at his feet are the material facts of the world. So right, even in there on the individual level, you have heaven and earth. And then if that individual is in a group or a family, they all revolve around some animating force. So it just kind of scales up. Guidance at the top, material world at the bottom. And then from family to community, same thing. Community to country, country to world, and world to existence itself. That same shape scales itself up. And in the ideal, everything's revolving around that one point at the very top. But say one community decides not to revolve around that thing at the top, and then it's suddenly in conflict with everything else. And yeah, so I guess that the hierarchy of consciousness idea is aiming at the ideal state of that, right? It's ideally, if we are all to be coexisting in peace, that's kind of how it would lay itself out. But we go off and we create our own gods in the forms of whatever ideologies or ideals that we decide are the ideal. And then that puts us in conflict with everyone else who have different ideals.
That's right. And none of us, so when you look at the, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about over the last few months is, okay, how, so if you read the Book of Revelation, passages from Isaiah, how can God end the story well? And you get these images or these symbols in Revelation and in Isaiah and in other places. And it's, I don't know. And that again has to be, it has to be a gift to us, because you're exactly right with those hierarchies. And when it comes to the principality that is Paul Vanderclay, it can't work. Mm-hmm. And if you want to see what the principality that is Paul Vanderclay looks like, you have to look at my life. And anyone, you look at me through YouTube and, oh, Paul's it all together. Talk to my wife. Talk to my kids. Talk to my church. Anybody who has a higher resolution of me knows they only know just some of my deficiencies. You know, God's list is longer. Mm-hmm. So we need a king. If we are actually, see, this is where what secularism does is it puts a ceiling on things. And so I've been watching the Ricky Gervais thing, Afterlife, and I come away from that and I'm just like, is this all you're asking for? Okay, so be nice to people until you die. That's the best we can have it. It's like, yeah, you really set the bar high there, buddy.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. Well, that reminds me. So when I worked out but when I was trying to figure out this idea of like the hierarchy of consciousness, and I went down to the individual. There's that conscious guidance at the top. Now every individual in the system is receiving conscious guidance from above, from the highest point, and it filters its way down. But to a secular materialist atheist, which I know their perspective well, all there is just that individual. That's it. It's just a flat plane full of those little individuals, each of which has their own little consciousness and all the material facts at their feet. And so like when Peterson would ask Sam questions, like why questions, it would go back trying to, where's the source of your morality? And he would say something like, it's self-evident. You know, it's like, well, so why is it moral for you to save your enemy's child from a burning building? And he'll just say, well, duh, it just is, you know, because he still feels that conscious guidance, like knocking on the top of his consciousness, but he's just looking at his feet and he's saying, well, I feel it. It's obvious. You know what I mean? And it must be obvious just based on these facts that I can see. You know, it's like he refused, not just him, but people of that mind refuse to look up and try to figure out where those things are coming from. It's just like, well, it's self-evident. They don't realize it's been handed to them through culture, through et cetera. But in this framework, just through this kind of consciousness that we all have, it's those kind of things are handed down.
It's, you know, them explaining the shape of our morality is like all the best videos I've never made. You know, they're in my head. They're so clear in my head, but I can't actually make a video that good, you know, and again, I'm going to do a video and I'm going to talk about all about this. It's all going to be clear. And, you know, no, then there's the video that I actually make. And so I've always get the sense with Brett Weinstein, he's talking about all the evolutionary and all of this has developed into this morality that we have. And it's like, well, then why are we even talking about it? I mean, and then suddenly we have to transcend this Darwinian morality. And well, where did you get this other morality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where's that good coming from? Well, we should transcend it. And it's like, who says should? You can't have that should unless there's a bigger should outside of the should that you're supposed to be transcending.
Basically. That's right. Otherwise, because isn't this part of your assassin robot programming? Where did you get the enlightenment or inspiration or revelation in order to transcend everything that the biological systems have bequeathed you with?
Yeah.
And to say, we have to stop playing this game or we'll kill each other. Okay. You know, and it's again, it's kind of like the guy who looks in the mirror and then forgets what his face looks like. No, you know your face. You've been describing your face to us, but you have no idea is where you're getting any of this information from. And so, but that's we're all like that.
Yeah.
That's how we are.
Yeah.
I probably derailed you. I should just shut
up. No. I'm derailing myself. There's a lot of tangents that I want to go on. Okay. Yeah, we'll go this way. So let's say we take that kind of model of reality, this kind of cone, and especially if you keep the idea of the groups, the principles and principalities, where there's individuals to groups to communities to cities, etc., and they're all circles within circles within circles, all revolving around this top thing. Now, if you were to look at that model from the bottom and see these wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels, I was thinking about this one day, and because I was listening to the Bible Project, and they were talking about Ezekiel's vision. And I was thinking, I had this idea in my head, this model, and I was thinking, I as a modern person would describe that as machinery or gears, you know, God's machinery, God's golden, you know, the inside of a watch kind of machinery, cogs. But an ancient person wouldn't, because they don't have that. And they were talking about Ezekiel seeing the wheels within wheels within wheels, and he called it the wheels of God's chariot. And they do a great podcast. The one guy is a little more kind of like American, kind of your standard American, would you say evangelical? I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
So he was kind of stuck more on the literal. He's like, so Ezekiel saw a chariot, and it's like, that's not, I don't think that's exactly the point. It's more like he saw, and to me, this might be my bias, but I think it's like he sees what this interacting you know, wheels within wheels of reality itself and how things are organized through our consciousness. And that's probably me making a giant leap. And, but to me, that's more what it's about. It's like he sees that. And even that vision organizes itself in that same thing where those wheels are at the bottom. It's also, they're attached to beasts, periphery beasts, you know, that are multiple, their multiplicity. And then God's at the top on his throne, of course.
And this is all coming to you through a text and a description. Mm-hmm. That too. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes artists will try to render elements out of the book of Revelation. One of my favorite ones is in the book of Revelation, you have the tree of life and it's growing. It's planted on both sides of the river of life. And you think about that and you say,
both sides.
How? So then you see artists with, you know, swooping things up.
Yeah.
But you very much have the sense that, okay, even with a common dream that we have, if we have a dream and you wake up and you try to articulate your dream, now pay attention to the tools you must use. You have to put it through your consciousness. I did one of the videos I did last week on, it could have been patterns and Peugeot and Peterson and Piaget. Someone dropped a comment in there which had an MP3 file from Rookmaker. Rookmaker was a Dutchman who was attached to Labrie. He had a very interesting little lecture on reality that he did back in the 70s. And he had a couple of really cool things in there. One of it was you only see what you already know. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to this description of the throne / chariot of the Lord that is shockingly by a irrigation canal outside of Babylon. And again, understand now Ezekiel is from the priestly class and he was taken into exile too young before he actually was able to serve in the temple. And then, you know, so much of Ezekiel's visions have everything to do with the temple and, you know, because that's who Ezekiel was. And all of this has to come to us via written text. And I mean, the whole thing. So, okay, so then what does he see? And how should we regard that which he sees?
Yeah, it's...
There's a reason there's all these books.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's rich, and it's... Yeah. And so then... It's revelation. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, it's some of the other ways we use that word, you know, when we wake up from a dream and suddenly in the dream, everything made sense about our lives. And it's like, I had a revelation. Well, what was it?
I'll get back to you on that. Yeah.
You better do it fast because another 15 minutes and it'll be gone. Ezekiel is such a... I did Ezekiel for my Sunday school class last year or the year before, and wow, people don't.
People. Yeah, I need to. I haven't read it. I've only, you know, I just kind of know bits and pieces. I'm working my way through the Bible slowly, but it's taking time. There's one more thing that I wanted to talk to you about because I know we're getting close, and it's. I think it's kind of about my personal, it kind of comes back to that analysis paralysis, I think. But I've noticed that there's a difference in the language that I use when describing stories from the Bible. It feels more comfortable to say things like Ezekiel sees the wheels at the bottom rather than saw. So using present tense versus past tense, Moses ascends the mountain rather than ascended the mountain, or he talks to the bush rather than he talked to it. And I don't know, using the present tense almost seems like you can place it in this ever ongoing mythological structure, where if you use the past tense, it's very historical, literalistic, in a way. And I mean, ideally, you should probably be able to bridge those two. But I notice that I trip up when I use the past tense. And I go, ooh, wait, do I mean that? Do I mean that he saw that? Or do I mean to say in the story he sees that? You know? And I catch myself a lot when I'm thinking about these things or talking about them.
Well, and different languages do different things with that. So Greek has a way sometimes of something that happened in the past that is continuing to manifest itself in the present. So The Greek language has a way of kind of embodying. In English, we have past, present. We also have the imperfect, which is also different. But right there, you just hit on, so there's this thing that happened. Well, is the Bible always happening? Well, yes. Did events in the Bible happen? Yes. Now, a parable, Jesus tells a parable in Luke 15 about a man had two sons. Now, is Jesus talking about a guy who lived down the street? No, it was a parable. So in that sense, that parable is purely, it's always happening and it never happened. But the Bible very much does not want to choose between that for important reasons for us. Because what tends to happen, if you don't have that rootedness in the physical world, you tend to have a Gnosticism which just sort of floats up and up and up and out of the world. And again, for me, over the last year and a half, in terms of if someone would ask the question, well, how has your Jordan Peterson journey? And it's very much a Jordan Peterson journey. It isn't, it's by no means just Jordan Peterson. It's people like you and Jonathan Peugeot and the dozens of people that I've had conversations with and the new things that I've read because of Peterson and all of this stuff. If there's one big thing that this has really changed in me, it is I am more certain both of the necessity of the historical resurrection of Christ and the historicity of it. It and even with a lot of the Jonathan Peugeot stuff, so we get certain important things, lots of roads travel through certain important things, including the Protestant Reformation. It's easy now to look back and say, ooh, the Reformation, it got a bunch of things mucked up, but it had to happen. Things had reached a breaking point in Western Christianity that had to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And some of that has to do with this question of symbolism and mythology. Tolkien, I love Tolkien's mythology. I love Middle Earth. And I remember I first read it in junior high. And as a junior high kid, for the life of me, I wanted that to be so true. I wanted to have Middle Earth with orcs and dwarves and wizards and elves. And I just, as a junior high kid, I just wanted to live in that world.
Yeah, me too.
And so now, in a sense, I say, yes, that world is real. But there's the resurrection of Christ is so important to me in terms of, you know, that he rose from the grave, that Mary grabbed onto him, that Thomas said, I ain't going to believe this. You know, you know, he's a modern, we think we're so different. I'm not going to believe this until, okay, Thomas. But the scars are still there. I mean, it's, and then suddenly I realize, oh man, the dream I had as a junior high kid living in Middle Earth, I've actually been given a gift that is far deeper and richer and better than that, because I actually inhabit the story from which Tolkien derived his subcreation, which was Middle Earth. But at the same time, I'm like Bilbo, and I don't like all these dwarves coming into my house and muddying up the carpets and dragging me to be eaten by trolls and get in the midst of a fight between the chief dwarf.
I just lost it now that you said it.
He and the elves, and Bilbo's like, you know, I'm gonna take the Arkenstone and I'm gonna hoodwink my friends because they're not behaving as they should. And you know, And yeah, my life is like that too. There's all kinds of issues and problems and ways I don't want to be in an adventure. And I long for the reunion of heaven and earth. So.
And you just have to trust that the author knows what he's doing, basically.
Yeah. And again, as Americans, oh, we hate that. Because because what if I'm Judas and not Peter? On the other hand, if you just frame it that way, and I know Calvinists have sometimes framed it that way, and many more times have been labeled as framing it that way. No, that's not exactly right too. And Augustine had that correct. Is that no? You do have choice, and you do have to exercise will. And if you're concerned that you've committed the unforgivable sin, you haven't. And all of Jesus' amazing promises, ask and it shall be given, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened. Those are all true. And we just can't square that with all the other stuff. But now you're back to your hierarchy where, no, we can't square it, but we do by faith believe that it finally does hold together. And the evidence for that is the way that we see cohesions and things holding together, even with the limited capacity we have to see it.
Yeah.
See, I talk too much.
No. That's why I watch your videos every day, to hear you talk. So.
Well, I got here late, so if you got another question or two, and I don't have anyone after you because, again, I had a glitch in my schedule. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could keep talking, but it's your time. So.
Well, we can go another 15.
Okay. Let's see. I've got my journal here.
I'll make you a deal. If we go another 15, you'll let me post this.
Oh, I'm already going to let you post it.
This has been a great conversation.
Yeah. You can post it. That's fine. Unless I say something very embarrassing in the next 15 minutes.
Well, then I'll edit it out because the rest of this has been gold.
Okay, cool. So one time I was listening to the podcast. So I don't even know if I knew the name of the podcast that I was listening to. But you said, I'm going to quote you real quick. You said, "I'm deeply secular, and there are wonderful things to be gained from this perspective. In some ways, the secular room makes a nice hallway for lots of other rooms. But what we're learning is that it's really hard to live in the hallway."
Yeah.
And that just, like, it's exactly where I am. And it made me think a lot of things. So aside from the personal stuff, first it made me, am I dropping out? It says my connection's unstable. Okay. So I think we emailed about this, but the discussion between Brett Weinstein and Jonathan Peugeot in, I can't remember where they were, somewhere in Canada. And it was like a Q&A at the end of some talk. And Weinstein he said, "I can't understand what I'm running afoul of here. If scientism," I guess is kind of what he was saying. It's not what he said, but "if that was belief system 1001, it is simply the best because it is the only one that can look at all the other systems and see why they're working and, you know, and explain them." And to me, that is the hallway, right? It's like you're in the hallway and you can see all the other rooms and you can kind of peek inside and see what's going on in there and you can compare them. But I mean, there's a few places to go from there. For one, he got into the hallway by leaving a room. So he brought the assumptions of the Judeo-Christian room into the hallway. But again, that was just interesting, you know, the hallway comparison. It's like, yeah, you're in this null space where you can see all these other systems going on and you can compare them and try to explain them, but it's not the same as being in them and participating in them and getting everything that comes from them. So that was interesting.
I don't remember him making that comment, but I'll assume you're retelling it correctly, which I have no reason to believe you wouldn't be. Every system imagines it can see the other system clearly. Mm. Just like every person imagines they see the world clearly. It's just a function of, we all stand in a place and evaluate through the eyes that we have. But what we don't do is, like, Sunday morning I got to church and I drove in and I saw someone had dumped a whole bunch of stuff around the dumpster. I was like, oh, the dumping. Oh, it's always the illegal dumping. And I went into church and I got busy with all of my things. And at one point I was out in the breeze when I looked over across the parking lot and I saw a shopping cart and more stuff. And it looked like, so there used to be a homeless man here, Daniel, who's got a restraining order. He can't come here, all this kind of stuff. But I saw the shopping cart and I saw a whole bunch of stuff that looked like one of Daniel's old encampments, and like, bang, right away in me. First two thoughts is, it's Daniel. Second thought is, why didn't I see that when I drove in? Mm. Now, it wasn't Daniel, but why didn't I see that when I drove in? It's, and this gets back to what Jordan Peterson, I think, so eloquently describes, that we imagine, I've told this story before too. I was friends with a guy who had very low vision, and he had the same experience we have of seeing, you know, I can, you know, here's my peripheral vision about here all the way to here, this whole image before me that my mind says, I'm just seeing the room as it is. There's Sam Harris. Mm-hmm. Well, I had my friend with low vision. He explained, he says, you know, I really see kind of like through a paper towel tube, but my mind fills in the gaps. Just like the reason I close one eye and I don't see the blind spot. My mind fills in the gaps. Mm-hmm. So, well, what does that say about how we see each other's systems? Mm-hmm. We're just filling in the gaps.
Well, it's what you said before. We see the things we know we're going to see. Right. So if you want to see simplistic fundamentalists who are idiots, that's what you're going to see when you look at the system.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or if you want to see godless scientists who believe in Darwin and are, and this is where I think, again, Peterson's, I've been listening to, trying to find all Peterson's Peugeot references, or not Peugeot, but Piaget references lately, because that was fascinating to me. And this idea of the equilibrated state that, you know, it is in a sense, if we're going to use the order chaos language, it's where order and chaos get it right at the center, and it goes out and it goes out and it just keeps going out. And the problem, you know, from let's say Steven Pinker's point of view, and Peterson talks this way sometimes too, boy, we've almost got poverty licked. Yeah, well, and they're absolutely right in that we don't have anywhere near the challenges we used to have with starvation, but we've done it at a cost of a number of things. One of a book that I read a number of years ago, which was really a fascinating book, The Alchemy of Air, was about the fixation of nitrogen. So basically, at the beginning of the 20th century, using only organic fertilizer, basically people guess the earth maybe has a carrying capacity in terms of food for maybe 3.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. And Germany in particular doesn't have very good land. Climate isn't particularly good. And Germany was always facing starvation. Now, this is one of the drivers for war. Always facing starvation. And so one of the German scientists, ironically a Jew, figured out how to pull nitrogen. Everybody was, you know, grabbing all the guano they could from South America. Figure out how to grab nitrogen from the air because it's all around us, and create, well, two things they could create with that: chemical fertilizer and explosives. Became really important for Germany in the early part of the 20th century. They had now a reliable source of nitrogen for explosives. But then you think about, okay, wow, we have this artificial fertilizer. Now we can fertilize, you know, and the European fields were worn out. That was part of the boon of coming to the New World, because the land wasn't worn out. Now we can reliably put nitrogen back into the soil at a far better rate than, let's just say, planting beans or something, which was sort of the old way in crop rotation. So now suddenly the world has maybe a food carrying capacity of 10 billion people. Yeah, but what have we done to the nitrogen cycle? And what happens with farm runoffs? And that's part of the way of that's part of the way of this particular scientistic paradigm. Yeah, let's feed everyone. So we've solved this problem, and we kind of sneakily created this problem. It's kind of like DDT. Look, go back to YouTube and find all the fun videos about DDT, and you know the guy's eating it in his porridge, and all the tribal guys are like, I ain't gonna eat that DDT. And of course, you know, then 20 years later, everybody's like, oh, we got to stop the DDT because it's killing the fish and the birds. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's why I'm so pessimistic of so many utopias, because we're just so bad at it.
Yeah.
And if you want to look at the cycle that has been, so then Peterson's talking about Piaget, you know, pay attention not just to the outcomes, but pay attention to the process. Well, here's the process. We see a problem. We use whatever power we can to fix the problem, usually at someone else's or something else's expense, and we solve our problem. Mm-hmm. And then we realize, oh, a lot of today's problems were the solutions to yesterday's problems. Horse manure was the problem. So now we have the internal combustion engine. Okay, now CO2 is a problem. And yes, we'll get comments about CO2. Mm-hmm. That's just an illustration of how we are. And this is where, again, you get back to your hierarchies. We're playing with these hierarchies. So let's not worry about gasoline and the internal combustion engine so we can get rid of all these horses, and let's not worry about what we're going to do the nitrogen cycle once we fixate nitrogen from the atmosphere. And this is what we're doing. And to imagine we'll do this forever, well, nobody even dares imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
You need God to imagine that.
Yeah, it raises the question to me. Do you keep messing things up by trying to fix it? Or, I mean, you can't just sit back and do nothing, right? We're always replacing problems with new problems.
Right.
So do you just bear that cross until the end? And then you just, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Well, and I think Peterson is right. And, you know, I read 12 Rules for Life, and so much good stuff in that book. There's so much, you know, he's been able to gain so much wisdom, so much good advice. And all that is good. People should get off the couch, brush off the dust from the Cheetos, and, you know, do what you've done. You know, find a woman, make a commitment, start a career, raise some children. You should do those things. That's what you're made to do. Mm-hmm. But in the Roman Catholic tradition, you have nature grace, and they kind of stack it up that way. That's what Roman Catholic theology does. You know, Calvinism tried to synthesize it into one. So your work is your worship. And you know, all of these systems, they're all our systems. So, mm-hmm. But no, we should do these things. And so let's assume that, yeah, we can put too much CO2 into the atmosphere for our own good. Well, let's see if we can do something about that. And so, you know, Peterson is right. And so when you get going on his sacrament, which is meaning, boy, let's pick up this cross of environmental degradation and start cleaning up this world. And you know what? This is the image of God in us it swells up, and we actually become heroic, and we do heroic things. This is what we were made to do. But we will always, so that's when Peterson's Augustinian anthropology comes in and says, yeah, and you're probably going to muck it up. And so you've got problems over here and problems over there. This is our lot. And so, you know, we pray for the grace of God. We ask God to move, and forward we travel. So, and that's exactly right.
Wow. Well, I think we wrapped it up pretty good there in the last 15 minutes.
Well, this has been fun. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I messed up my schedule and did a conversation today. This has been
great. Thank you. Yeah.
I needed this because I'm all, you know, I've got a million things I've got to do before we leave. That, you know, I haven't left the country in years, you know, back in the missionary days, and all the kids are coming. And cool. So I'm just kind of like, oh, there's a million details, and wrangling a bunch of, you know, young adults is different from wrangling a bunch of little kids when they're a little demigod in the house. That's like, have your stuff down here at this time or you're not coming.
Yeah.
Yes, Dad.
Yeah. So you've kind of talked about it. At one point you said that Peterson was going to be doing like a call in to the,
it's not going to happen. It's
not going to happen. So are you going to be just speaking with John Anderson and then giving
and
a few
John points? Anderson's not going to be there either.
Oh, it's a Paul Vanderclay show.
It's going to be the Paul Vanderclay show. So actually I got to make a video right after this and post it. And see, actually the guys who set this up, you know, they said to me, they said, it'd be really great if like, you could do a conversation with Jordan Peterson and John Anderson and we could tape that. And that could be the kickoff for the show. I thought, yeah, that'd be really great. I thought, boy, I hope they can get Peterson and Anderson on board. And then they said, so why don't you get Peterson? It's like, oh, how am I supposed to do this?
Yeah.
Have you seen the guy's schedule?
Yeah. Right.
So actually, so I sent Jordan an email and he responded right back to me. It's the kind of said the setup. He said, yeah, I'd like to do this, but, you know, but look at how the dude's been living. So yeah. I, you know, Jordan Peterson owes me nothing. I am 100% gratitude to Jordan Peterson for the work that he has done for this world. I really am, because I think I'm a fanboy through and through. I haven't flipped like a bunch of other people. The stuff he has given us has been, I think, gold.
Yeah.
But I'm a 55-year-old. I'm more his contemporary rather than, you know, a son. So at the same time, he's another guy, you know, and he's got all the same issues I got. So to have him say, on one hand, I know I'm sure that I've flaked on other people for probably far lesser reasons than he couldn't have the conversation with me. So and for these guys in Australia, you know, when they contacted me a few months ago, I thought they had to be out of their mind. I thought, who on earth is going to actually show up and listen to me? I know who shows up and listens to me. The room ain't that big over here.
Yeah.
but it's been, you know, whatever happens, I'm grateful for the opportunity. And the truth is, you know, so then I go around this and I do these meetups in different parts of the country when I can like get my travel paid for by, you know, somehow. And you sit down in a room and if 4 people show up or if 10 people show up or if 30 people show up, it's all good.
Yeah.
Just like these conversations. I mean, people, total strangers to me, sign up to talk to me for an hour.
Yeah.
And some people look at that and say, you gotta be crazy. What, you know, what if they're an idiot? Well, I'm an idiot too. So it'll be 2 idiots.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got my YouTube channel started with the Freddie and Paul show. This is who I am.
Yeah.
and then to meet cool people like you, I mean, that's been just the joy of this whole thing.
Yeah. I've loved watching your channel grow. Since the very beginning, I think I watched your first video.
Really?
And it's funny. Yeah. Your first video on Peterson.
Yeah.
And it's funny the journey that I've come on, because I was still very much in my kind of atheistic materialistic phase, but I was really hooked on Peterson's work. And then I was like, oh, this guy's, it's all Christian. Like, can I really approach this stuff? You know what I mean? And then I just kept watching and watching more Peugeot and doing my own reading. And as I'm miles away from where I was just a year and a half ago, and all for the better.
Yeah,
so I really appreciate everything you do. I know you hear that a lot, but it's appreciated.
I feel, now you're going to make me cry. Or you used to watch Peterson break up, but I feel nothing but gratitude for what has happened over this time frame for me. It's been so much fun.
you know, and to me, I'm a Christian, so I just say God is so good. God is so good. And this is why, you know, people get pessimistic and yeah, there's reasons to be afraid. And yeah, the wheels could come off our civilization and yeah, we could cook the earth or yeah, we could blow it up. There's so many things that bad that could happen, but the real comfort and joy of being a Christian is to actually have a sense in your deepest self that, you know what, the world, God is the best storyteller that there can be. And the story of this earth, although for many people and in many places and times, crushingly sad and tragic, that a God who can make the glory of Yosemite National Park, a God who can make the amazing creatures that human beings really are, this God can take the suffering and tragedy of this world, and in some ways, the deeper the tragedy, the greater the glory he can make out of it. And when I see that and have a vision for that, you know, talk about meaning as sacrament, I'm flushed with meaning, and there's almost, you know, and meaning and courage and love, and it's a, for me, it's I've never done drugs, so I don't know what drugs feel like, but for me it's like a drug, and it gives me joy and confidence that God is good, and in the end, despite all of our questions, his will be done, and it will be better than any of us can imagine, and we will see it. And that, to me, boy, no better way to live. So,
wow. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate it, Paul. This has been a really good talk.
Sorry I did so much preaching to you today.
No, but hey, I'm still trying to find a church. I need some preaching, so...
Well, thank you so much, Cord. And yeah, with your permission, the problem is when I have a great conversation like this, it's like, I want to post this right now.
Yeah. No, well, you have my permission.
Control.
Yeah, you have my permission. You can post this for sure. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Cord. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.